focus on, then we could have discussed what we'll discuss today and whatever else Jim has on his mind. He's my special guest today. He told me that he was writing an article, a detailed article, on Hugo Chavez. He sent it out. I've got it in front of me. I read it. He calls it President Chavez, a 21st century Renaissance man. I simply can't get his death out of my mind. I've written a number of articles about it. His entire illness defies logical explanation except for the only one I can come up with. Cancer is certainly very commonplace. Many people are affected with cancer. If it's caught early enough, nearly always it's very treatable. Sometimes there are recurrences. If they're caught early enough, they're treatable. Chavez had 4 cancer surgeries in 18 months. That's almost unheard of. He had the most expert care anybody could get. With that kind of a situation, early detection, expert care, he died. Well, I think Obama ordered him killed and succeeded. Maybe Jim could comment on that. But Jim, your article was very important. I wish everybody would read it. Again, President Chavez, a 21st century Renaissance man. Let me let you talk about it.
I thought about the 13 years of elected presidency of President Chavez. I started to reflect upon his thinking, his religious beliefs, his philosophy, and his practice. And what I came away with was far more impressive than day-to-day readings about his particular social reforms of the day, his particular defense of countries being under a siege or attack. And I thought, what is the method behind, what is the ethics that guide Chavez? Because he's a very ethical man. When we have presidents like Obama who usurped the power to assassinate American citizens, who sanction terrorism and torture, we have President Chavez who was so sympathetic to the plight of people, even his enemies, when they try to assassinate him. He forgave them amnesties. Some of them even avoided prosecution. Chavez never assassinated anyone. Chavez never ordered the torture, waterboarding of anyone. Chavez built a social program at a time when every European government and in North America and Europe are cutting programs, and they use the excuse of a crisis. And we look at who benefits and who loses. It's always the working people, the minorities, who lose. And when we look at Chavez, he's put the entire burden of the economic crisis, and Venezuela went into the crisis because it's a global economy. There was no cuts in social programs. There wasn't any firings of school teachers like takes place in Chicago and New York and elsewhere. He went straight forward to the bankers and went to the corporate elite and says, you're going to pay higher taxes. He went to the foreign oil companies and said, you're going to pay greater royalties. And when the food distribution companies try to take advantage of shortages, he intervened. He nationalized them, turned them over to public authorities, and made food available. So in very, very many ways, both in the ethical sense, he stands out as a beacon, as an alternative to the political corruption and pro-plutocrat elites that we have. And the fact is that one aspect that I didn't take up but is essential is that Chavez implemented policies that had a tremendous impact on people of African Indian descent and immigrants from Colombia and other countries who flocked to Venezuela because of its economic growth and found jobs and got citizenship. They weren't rounded up. Their houses weren't broken into. They weren't assaulted. They weren't salted away in jail, indefinite detention, as the Obama administration has done to hundreds of thousands of Central American and Mexican immigrants. In every way, he stands as a polar opposite of what we've been accustomed to seeing in the United States. And he demonstrated in life itself that there is an alternative. There are policies. There are ways of treating immigrants, of dealing with unemployment that favor people and penalize the rich. And Chavez demonstrated this in his legislation, his executive orders, his direct contact with people. And I think the fact that he was of African and Indian descent is a very important factor in linking his programs to his identification with the Bolivarian history. The Bolivarian history is a history of struggles against colonialism. And I think the fact that we have a person of African descent in the United States who serves the privileged white oligarchy, it stands in great contrast to Chavez, who showed that a person of color doesn't forget his roots and can work with people on a day-to-day basis to improve their lot, and doesn't resort to demagogy and put on a phony Afro-American accent like Obama does, who spent all of his life in elite schools, elite legal circles, etc. I think that's also an important contrast that we should take into account. And he was a universal man. Now, he wasn't just interested in Venezuela, or even Latin America, which he greatly enhanced the integration of Latin American peoples. He also was a great supporter of the Palestinians against Israeli annexation. He opposed the war on terrorism, and he made the most audacious statement at the height of the hysteria of 9/11. He says, you don't fight terrorism with state terror. And Washington never forgave him for standing up to Bush and the war machine and saying, look, if you have conflicts and problems, the best way is to deal with the social underlying social causes. And now people who say, well, the Iraq war was wrong, Israel should stop persecuting the Palestinians. Well, Chavez laid down the very philosophy that informs that. He says, look, if you have conflict, sit down and negotiate. You want to deal with Al-Qaeda and you identify them in Afghanistan, accept the offer of the Taliban to sit down and negotiate and demonstrate your evidence that the refugees in Afghanistan involved in a coup. No, they went to war. They shoot first and think later. And Chavez was the opposite. Think first, sit down as equals, and negotiate settlements. And again, once again, I can't emphasize greatly enough the fact that Chavez stands out of all the leaders in the world as the person that most pursued social justice and peace in a time of war, corrupt politicians, and politicians linked to colonialism, linked to power groups in the United States like the Israeli lobby, who listened to the Saudi sheikhs instead of the Arab poor who are in the streets demonstrating. Chavez was the exact opposite, and I think he stands out, and that's why your suspicions of an assassination warrant serious consideration.
Jim, I absolutely go along with all of that. He truly was amazing. He knew because of what he did throughout his tenure, beginning February 1999 until March 5th this year. I mean, he literally spoke truth to power. He knew that he was going up against Washington and the internal dark forces in his own country, and the CIA had him a marked man, and Bush and Obama had him a marked man, and money poured in to do anything possible. to get rid of him, and he still stood up courageously, and you have to judge him by what he did. I think he truly believed in the policies that he instituted and got put in place. I think he truly believed it. He spoke it. The policies speak for themselves. The duplicitous politicians, you know, they mouth the good things like Obama, and they go out and do exactly the opposite. But Chavez made promises, and he kept them. He was a real leader. He wasn't perfect. Nobody's perfect. But he's the exception that proves the rule, and he's an immense loss. I don't think Bolivarianism is going by the board, Jim. I think it's very strong and institutionalized, and I really believe that Maduro, who run for elections on April 14th against the oligarch representative Enrique Capriles, I think, in plain English, Jim, I think Maduro will clean his clock.
Well, there's no question about that. I think it's very clear that the vast majority, maybe as much as two-thirds of the electorate, will vote for the socialist Maduro. But I think also we have to keep in mind that Chavez was a great teacher. I mean, all of his speeches were educational speeches about Venezuela's history, its great leaders. He marked out the social agenda. He taught people what they should demand of a government. He taught them their social rights and emphasized the independence and dignity of being a Venezuelan, of being a Latin American. He really attacked the servility of the elites, the ethos, the consumerist ethos from Miami. He told people the most important thing is social solidarity, of supporting the family, of bringing up kids healthy with free clinics, free education up through the universities. There's no student debt in Venezuela because there's no tuition. There's dormitories that are free to students as they attend the university. Now, the fact that Chavez was such a great teacher, a teacher of civic virtues, of citizenship, was very important in saving Chavez when the U.S. military and ambassador backed the coup, because 1 million people came down from the slums in less than 10 hours, surrounded the palace, and demanded Chavez be free by the coup makers and their kidnapping. And Chavez anticipated. He had the paratroopers in the palace. The second he was grabbed, the paratroopers captured the coup makers and said, you got 1 hour to free Chavez, and then you may not have that head on your shoulders. And Chavez was free by this combination of loyal military constitutionalists and the great majority of citizens who had been awakened to their democratic rights and demanded the coup makers be ousted and democracy restored. Now, that is an amazing occurrence. Most coups in Latin America result in long-term dictatorships, some up to 20 years. And Venezuela, they didn't last 24 hours. And I think that citizenship itself was an educational experience for Chavez, because he learned the best defenders, the only people you can really count on to defend democratic freedoms, are the working people. And the worst enemies are these wealthy elites and disloyal collaborators of Washington, including some members of the armed forces. And I think this idea of looking at the political process as a one-way street, Chavez was a great teacher, but he also was a great listener, learning. And he spoke in a language people could understand. He didn't use some of this leftist jargon and esoteric language that some of these people, academics and others, they talk it down to the people in such a with such foreign terminology. They don't communicate to anybody but themselves. And Chavez was a great communicator, as well as a great reformer. And I think that's something which people on the progressive side of the political agenda have to learn. And Chavez stood up against military intervention when the peace movement in this country was disintegrating and sucking up to the Democratic Party. Chavez said, no, first principles, and then you decide what party supports those principles, and that's who you ally with. No, Chavez would never have participated in any form or fashion in the Democratic Party. In the case of Venezuela, he rejected the two-party system, Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats. He said, no, these are corrupt parties. These are parties that have been stealing from the Treasury. These are people that have inflated military budgets. We have to start all over. The first thing he did when he was elected is convoke a constitutional assembly, drew up a new constitution that increased the participation of citizens, made the government responsible to the people. And then he went forth and began to develop a social agenda, a foreign policy that was independent and rejected terrorism and wars. And he went further, and he declared that the United States had to deal with a unified Latin America on an equal basis or take a walk. And that all defines why I consider Chavez a multifaceted leader that goes far beyond any other president in the 21st and probably most of the 20th century.
And I truly believe a humble common man because of its roots. And Jim, I remember writing that when the Constitution was put together, he held two referenda. One, he asked Venezuelans, do you want a national referenda on a new Constitution? And it won overwhelmingly. And then he had a second one after the Constitution was drafted. People, ordinary Venezuelans, had a right to say up or down, do you want this thing or do you not want this thing? Overwhelmingly, it passed again, and people value this. They keep a little pocket-sized constitutions on their person, and it's not small. It's got hundreds of articles in it. I mean, you could the U.S. Constitution is a fraction of the Venezuelan Constitution, and it's got such marvelous provisions in it. Guaranteeing free health care, free education, indigenous people's rights, on and on and on, the kind of stuff that is absolutely absent in the U.S. Constitution. U.S. Constitution expresses rights that really aren't enforced, and Venezuela's Constitution has marvelous rights in their state policy, and they have been as long as Chavez has been president. Really astonishing, Jim. I agree with you.
Well, see, Steve, there's one last dimension I want to mention, and that is the horrendous lies that were published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, the L.A. Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, CBS, ABC, NBC. They demonized Chavez. They said he was a strong man. He was authoritarian. He was a dictator. He was a clown. Chavez participated in 13 elections, 4 presidential elections. He won by significant margins. There were 100 observers, including former President Jimmy Carter, who vouched that these are the cleanest elections they've ever witnessed anywhere, including the United States. So they invented a demon, and then they promulgated it in the newspapers and in the media. They said he was wrecking the economy. The United States has been stagnating. High levels of unemployment, high levels and growing numbers of poverty. 50,000 people in New York City that are living in shelters and growing. Chavez's economy grew 6% over the last 10 years. Chavez doesn't have a fiscal debt to speak of. It's all manageable. The external accounts are relatively safe and secure. The social expenditures have been expanding. Chavez has instituted a program for growth for the next 6 years. He's got this 1913 to 1919 economic plan for investments in diversifying the economy, increasing self-sufficiency in food, expanding the welfare program, job training and job creation, etc. They never discussed that. It's never been discussed in the media. Chavez has been presented as a failed monster at the time when the plans that these newspapers are proposing, austerity and cutbacks and bailouts, are failing. So if the newspapers of choice in this country would simply look under their noses, they'd have plenty to criticize instead of projecting the failures in the United States on a successful, popular, Democratic president.
Jim, so true. I do a lot of media critiques, and I've done a number of them over the years that I've been writing. The U.S. media portray Hugo Chavez. I did one after he died. I found an absolutely appalling Wall Street Journal editorial. It was full of one lie after another. I mean, it was so far from the truth. They didn't stretch the truth. They simply ignored it, and you manufactured a vilification pattern of again one lie after another. And I concentrated on them. I think I mentioned the New York Times in it as well. I've done New York Times critiques on the way they report about Venezuela. I remember the reporter who now has a different venue, a man named Romero. I think somebody by the name of Newman reports from Venezuela or generally that region, and he covers Venezuela. But again, they get it all wrong. They do it deliberately. They publish propaganda. This marvelous system. I mean, when you have a country that the people in the country en masse, not all of them, but the great majority, they love their leader. They come out en masse supporting him. There were times a million people will come out on the street to hear him or to do it supportingly. This is unheard of in America, Jim. Who on earth would come out to en masse and support Obama or George Bush or the man in the moon? It just does not happen. But it happens all the time in Venezuela. It did for Chavez. Maduro now has to earn his bona fides. I think he will, and they'll support him the same way. And I think Bolivarianism will continue, and I don't think the dark forces in Washington or anywhere else are going to get rid of it. They better learn that
Steve,
lesson.
Steve, you can just look at the photos that have come through Venezuelan television. Over 5 million people have passed by the bier of Chavez, and there's still huge lines that are 5 or 6 miles long, people waiting 5 and 6 hours to pay homage, the last goodbye to President Chavez. You'd never get something like this for any Western leader. People coming down from the hills, tired, ill, whatever, they go and wait. That's the attachment, their final say to their beloved president, and nothing of this appears in the media to show these long lines, long waits of the common people. One-fifth of the entire country has been attending these beers. They come in bicycles, they come with buses, they walk down from the hills. It's a very impressive send-off,
Jim,
and it tells you much more. Just looking at those photographs, it tells you much more about the heritage of Chavez, because these people are not going to let the U.S. turn back the clock. And the greatest obscenity, and there have been many obscenities of Washington, Obama, is that they actually had two military officials, spies, working to destabilize the government. Right after Chavez died, they caught two embassy personnel who were actually engaged in conversations with certain high military officials, trying to coax them and convince them to become traitors to their country. No respect for the living or the dead.
It really is terrible, Jim. I think the original plan was to leave Chavez on display for 7 days. But I think what's going on is, as long as people want to file past him and pay their last respects, they're going to leave him on display. And who knows? It's possible that half the country could come by to pay honor to him. Again, absolutely unprecedented. It's inconceivable that percent of a country would come by to honor a fallen leader, but that's what's going on in Venezuela. And this never happened in America. I don't think it ever happened anywhere, but it's happening,
Steve,
in Venezuela.
What do you think is going to happen now, to change the subject? Obama is going to Israel. What is going on? Are they going to cook up the war with Iran? Is this simply a goodwill gesture? What is going to come of this ominous visit of Obama and Netanyahu. I read today where Obama said that that Iran will have an atomic weapon, an atomic bomb, in probably 1 year. And Netanyahu's comment on that is, if the sanctions fail to stop the nuclear research, we will bomb Iran. And then just a few minutes, I got the the email from the 51 presidents of American Jewish organizations who completely endorse Netanyahu's threats to bomb Iran. So what do you make of all this, Steve? Are they really going to plan a coordinated attack on Iran? Will the presidents of the major American Jewish organizations endorse an attack on Iran, which will have enormous consequences for the American economy, the Iranian people?
It's a question I wrestle with all the time, Jim. If it happens, I call it madness, absolute madness. There are high-level people in government currently and previously, both in Israel and America, who absolutely want nothing to do with this. You've got Pentagon commanders who don't want to touch it. I've written about Israeli officials, some present, but I think mostly past, who've come out very, very strong against any conflict against Iran. Iran threatens no one. Its nuclear program is absolutely legal. U.S. intelligence says so every single year. Iran is the most heavily surveilled country in the world. 16 U.S. intelligence agencies come out with an annual assessment. Every year they say the same thing. There's not a shred of evidence that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon. Netanyahu knows it. Obama knows it. The European leaders know it. They're going to go to war over this. It just seems crazy, Jim. If I had a bet, I wouldn't want to bet on it, but if I had a bet, I would say it won't happen. But you never know. There are lots of crazies in the country. I remember writing about Curtis LeMay during the Kennedy years. He wanted to nuke the Russians while we had an advantage of them. And thankfully, we had Kennedy instead of George Bush. During one national security meeting, he was so angry, he stormed out of the room. Can you imagine Obama doing something like that?
Well, Obama's speech is reinforcing Netanyahu's insane plan to bomb Iran. In fact, the Congress, under the prodding of American-Israel Political Action Committee, has just approved a resolution saying that if Israel attacks Iran, the U.S. is obligated to support Israel and go to war with Iran. That is, they've abdicated making U.S. foreign policy. U.S. policy is now contingent on what the Israelis decide to do, thanks to the pro-Israel lobby in the United States. What do you think of that?
Oh, I wrote about it. It was a non-binding resolution, but they can take the non-binding and make it very binding, Jim. And this stuff passes overwhelmingly. I mean, they do it by voice votes. Nobody votes against this stuff. The Israeli lobby is omnipotent. What it wants, it generally gets. It hasn't gotten a war yet.
How is that, Steve? You're in Chicago. There's a significant number of Zionists in Chicago, very powerful and influential. In fact, they launched Obama's presidential campaign. What is your impression? Are they very much involved in this kind of politicking for war for Israel?
I don't know, Jim. I have no personal contact with them, but I remember your writing about how the Zionists launched this campaign. I mean, Obama was lives on the south side of Chicago. He was an Illinois state senator. Oh, my goodness, we are out of time. We are out of time. Such important stuff, Jim. I'll stay on this thing. I'm taking a look at what may happen when Obama goes to Israel. I may have to say something about it. Jim, it was marvelous having a chance to spend most of the program discussing Chavez. We'll do more of that, and I look forward to having you back next month.
Well, Steve, publications, your articles are first on my agenda every morning. So
kind to say it. I couldn't wait for this one you wrote in Venezuela. I've got to sign off. I'll just remind listeners, tune in over the weekend at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.